From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Millions of Americans will take to the highways and byways tomorrow and Thursday. Today, we're going to offer some tips to get you safely and soundly to your family gathering. We'll also learn about the latest in self-driving technology. We'll get an update on the VW emissions recall and learn about the latest award-winning vehicles as designated by U.S. News and World Report. And speaking of that fine publication, welcome back to Maine Calling, Jamie Page Deaton. She's the automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report. And welcome back to you as well, John Paul. He's a master mechanic and senior manager of public affairs for AAA Northeast. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. Do you own a VW that's subject to recall? Are you wondering what you should do to get your car ready for winter? We're here to answer your questions. The number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or tweet at Maine Calling, and of course, post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back to you both. Jennifer, I know, likes to start the show when she is hosting you two to talk about what you've been driving lately as you have the opportunity to test various cars. Jamie Page Deaton, what are you driving?
Well, let's see. This week, I was driving the Toyota Camry, which is, you know, it's a Camry. It's pretty comfortable. Gets you where you need to go. A couple of cars that I've been really excited about was when I was in Hell, Michigan, for testing for North American Car and Truck of the Year. One of my favorites was the Hyundai Elantra. It was just a great little affordable small car. Really fun to drive, and I was having the time of my life taking it on these back roads through Michigan, and I was still getting 40 miles to the gallon. So for the money, it seemed like a great car, and I really, really liked it. Can't wait to get some more time in it. Also been a big fan of driving the Audi A4 that they redesigned for 2017. It's just really, I think, set the benchmark for the midsize luxury car class. Really great tech, fun to drive. You can dial in the suspension and the various drive characteristics just how you like it. Great interior space. Nice upscale design. So it really, I think, you know, if you're shopping for a midsize luxury car, the Audi A4 is really one you should be looking at.
Nice. John Paul?
Well, it hasn't been a great time for me. I recently spent a week in the Mitsubishi Mirage. Now, the Mitsubishi Mirage is a 78-horsepower, three-cylinder economy car that, well, what I tried to say was, you know, I really wanted to give Mitsubishi kind of a A for effort, but a C for execution. It was just, I drove it a lot that week. I probably put close to 900 miles on it. It got hybrid-like fuel economy, which is good. It's not fun to drive. It doesn't ride particularly well. It's not very quiet. But if you're looking for a very basic car that actually has some interesting features like push-button start and satellite radio and the ability to, you know, sync your iPhone or Android phone up to it, so it had Apple CarPlay. It had some interesting features in it, although really I'd rather see all those features go away, including HID headlights, the xenon headlights that are usually on a premium car, and make the car a $12,000 car and sort of say, well, this is what you get for 12 grand, as opposed to 17 or 18,000 and you get, well, a pretty uninspiring car that I think, unless you were looking at it to have it live in the city and get good mileage, not the most fun car to drive. And just this morning, I got into the Ford Explorer. I haven't driven a Ford Explorer since the last generation Ford Explorer, and it's actually a quite nice vehicle. It has grown up in size. It's gotten a little bit bigger. It has seating for up to seven. Decent ride, good handling. This one has the EcoBoost V6 engine, so it has a turbocharged engine. It has well over 350 horsepower when you need it, and decent gas mileage when you need it when you don't have all that power that you really need for. So it really was a surprisingly good SUV if you need something that borders on a big SUV.
Mm. I was hoping to jump in here as well. I have a story to share. I was lucky enough to get a ride this morning right before the program in a Tesla S P90D performance model with Portland Tesla owner Tim Soley, who was nice enough to take me for a spin here on 295. 762 horsepower. And at first I thought, oh, well, this is a, you know, it's a nice luxury car. It's a nice interior. It's got a big screen that was, you know, very high tech, connected directly to Tesla, that you could get upgrades from. It controlled, you know, the everything from the sunroof to other parts of the car. So there weren't a lot of knobs. And I thought that's interesting. And then he said, would you like to test out the acceleration? And I said, we said, sure, you know, why not? This was the insane mode acceleration. And I have to tell you, for those 4 seconds going from 0 to 60, or the 3 whatever seconds it was, I could not speak. I was, I guess I went pale. It was a really shocking experience. Forces over 1G. This is an incredible experience, and I just wanted to share it. I'm not sure I'd want to do that every day heading out to work, but have either of you experienced that?
Jamie? I have not. I, you know, my boss's boss has a Model S. I think people down around my pay grade aren't buying one. And I have driven it, you know, around the block, but I've never done it in launch mode. But I think what, one of the appeals of a Tesla, or really any electric car, is, you know, when you're driving a gasoline car, you have to wait for the engine to sort of spool up to give you all of its power output. When you're talking about an electric car, though, you've got a motor. All of its power is available from the get-go. So, you know, I drove a couple weeks ago the Chevrolet Bolt, which is Chevy's entry into the electric car, into the world of electric cars. And it's really impressive. It doesn't have quite the power that the Tesla does, particularly in, you know, insane or ludicrous mode. But, you know, this is a small car. It really kind of looks like a small crossover more to my eye, because it's fairly tall. But, you know, again, you have all of the power that it has is available right on tap. So from a dead stop, you can really kind of knock your passengers back and have a good time with it.
And on this question of electric cars, it's really coming down to what consumers will expect for range, for battery range, right? This is what this all hangs on, as to whether people will make the switch.
I think it's a combination of range and price. So right now, electric cars are still more expensive than gasoline power cars. I think the Bolt, you know, will come in around, you know, $30,000, even after, and that's after you have a whole lot of tax credits put in place. And then you've also got to look at the cost of potentially, you know, retrofitting your house with a fast charging station. And so that cost is one part of it, because at this point, you know, most people are thinking, well, gas prices are low. It just doesn't make economic sense for me to pay more for a car that's not going to, you know, that's going to take several years for me to make back that extra outlay of cost in terms of fuel savings. But range is definitely part of it as well. You know, nobody wants to be taking a road trip and have to stop every 200 miles and then have to wait, you know, 3 hours for the car to charge back up. And I mean, now you've got, with Tesla and some other manufacturers, you've got a range of charging a charging network. So you can stop and take maybe, say, 20 minutes to charge the car back up. So that's making it, I think, a lot more palatable. But, you know, To be honest with you, I'm a big fan of electric cars. If I lived in an area where I had a little bit more of a commute, and, you know, I would certainly be driving one. But I think for a lot of consumers at this point, you know, they're making their decision about what kind of car they're going to buy with their wallets. And if you sit down and you do the math on sort of a per mile basis and the full cost of the car, for a lot of people, it just doesn't make sense yet. Gas prices go back up, well, then we'll see.
And you say yet. I'm wondering, do you think that there are consumers who are saying, you know, I think I'll wait a couple years till the technology, you know, develops further and the batteries are better or whatever, that this is a technology that, while it's here, might be better a few years later?
Absolutely. And I mean, as more, you know, technology gets developed and it becomes more mainstreams, and as, you know, companies start to recoup their investment in terms of development, the price of electric cars will start to go down. The other thing is, I mean, if you're somebody who's really interested in an electric car and really wants to get one on a budget, now you have sort of the first generation of mainstream electric cars coming off of their leases. So in states where, like, for example, the Fiat 500e was sold, you can, or they would, you know, lease them to consumers, and now they're coming off the leases, so you can find one at a very good price. Same with the Nissan Leaf. I think I've seen used Nissan Leafs, which have, you know, a fairly short range, but they're only about $8,000.
And it's is battery replacement an issue there in the used ones, or is that usually
absolutely
taken care of? Yeah.
Yeah, you have to check the battery warranty, see if it's transferable. You're going to have to cover yourself, you know, from those angles. But if you really just want to get into an electric car and are willing to deal with kind of the issues that go with a first generation one and not a brand new one, well, you know, some of these used ones are a good option. But the other option is just waiting for the technology to become more affordable.
All right, we're going to come back to the recent release of the North American Car and Truck and Utility Finalists of the Year that you were a judge for, I believe. So we'll come back and talk about that, and also Brands of the Year, according to U.S. News and World Report. But, John Paul, a lot of people are planning in the next few days to launch to their relative's house for Thanksgiving. What advice would you give to them in terms of traffic, avoiding traffic, getting there safely? We've heard that this is going to be one of the busiest traffic years in the Northeast in maybe a decade. Probably then not wise to take off Wednesday at 3 in the afternoon.
You're absolutely right. This is the biggest amount or the largest amount of people we've seen travel since 2007. There's nearly 49 million people that are going to be traveling more than 50 miles from home. And a lot of those people are going to be right here in New England. This is a great place to spend the Thanksgiving holiday. And we expect, there's going to be a lot of people on the road Wednesday afternoon, Thursday morning. So just sort of let technology kind of be your guide as well. Look at all the traffic apps and different things to try to plan your time. Along with, you know, going to grandma's house with the apple pie, bring a certain amount of patience with you because you may run into some traffic jams. And again, we expect the traffic to be heavy Wednesday afternoon, Thursday morning. And the good thing is the Thanksgiving weekend, so what we look at from Wednesday to Sunday, it sort of spreads out on the return trip. So although we may see heavy traffic in the typical areas where you would see heavy traffic on Wednesday afternoon and Thursday, on the return trip, Saturday or Sunday, those people are going to spread out a little bit more, so we don't expect it to be quite as bad. Although Friday, for the big shopping day, you know, you could expect to see a lot of traffic around the malls. Also, if you're flying, this is air travel is up considerably over the past few years as well. And, you know, check with your airports. And one thing for people, you know, people that are flying out of, for instance, Boston, one issue that can be in Boston is you can get on your flight, okay, you just can't find a place to park your car.
Right. You mentioned apps. Do you have any favorite apps for traffic avoidance, for example?
Well, a lot of people like Waze. I'm not a huge lover of that, only because I find it just takes up too much memory and too much battery life. I'm a big Google Maps person with the traffic overlay. I think it does a great job. And if I'm planning to go somewhere, I look at it and go, oh yeah, that road's all red. It's going to take me an extra 45 minutes. And it's fine if I know it's going to take me an extra 45 minutes, and I plan accordingly. So there are a lot of good ones out there. Definitely look at them all. This is because we're seeing some of the lowest gas prices we've seen in quite a while. In the last just about 4 years, you know, 4 years ago on Thanksgiving, gas was, you know, on a nationwide average about $3.50 a gallon, and now we're around $2.15. So some significant savings for people with as far as what they're spending on gas. But this is a holiday like the Christmas holiday. This is a holiday where people tend to come back home, and, you know, whether it's college kids coming back home, this is where we tend to see kind of a lot of that cocooning sort of nature that families have and get back together again.
And if you need an excuse to leave Saturday morning at 6 o'clock, you could just say it's the traffic. I'd love to stay.
I've had enough of the relatives and it's time to go.
Right. 1-800-399-3566, the number to join the conversation. Today we'll go to the phones in a few minutes here. But Jamie Page Deaton, we want to get back to U.S. News and World Report's finalists for the North American Car and Truck and Utility. Explain what that is and what the finalists are. You were a judge for this, by the way.
Yeah, this is North American Car and Truck of the Year is an award that's voted on by a panel of about 60 automotive journalists. And it doesn't have very much to do with U.S. News and World Report other than working there helped me get on the jury.
I see.
But basically what they do is they look at the cars that are all new or redesigned for the upcoming model year and vote on the ones that they feel in each category that really move the benchmark forward. And so last week at the LA Auto Show, they announced the finalists. So for Car of the Year, the finalists were the Chevrolet Bolt, the Volvo S90, and the Genesis G90, which is a really kind of an interesting mix of cars because the Bolt, as I talked about before, is an EV. It's one of the few, I think, electric cars that I've encountered where it's you don't have to make any compromises in terms of space or comfort or drivability, and even the range is fairly good at about 250 miles on a full charge. The Volvo S90 is a luxury sedan that's actually quite affordable. And, Keith, you were talking about the giant screen in the Tesla.
Yeah.
The S90 has a similar sort of screen, but it also has, in terms of interior tech, some really great features like voice commands. So you can just hit a button and say to the car, "I'm hot," and it'll turn the air conditioner on for you. So you don't even have to take your eyes off the road at all. You can control most of the functions very easily through voice commands. And that was something I was initially skeptical of because I don't know if it's just something about my voice, but a lot of the voice commands in cars don't always work for me. But in the S90, I was able to say, "I'm hot, turn on my seat warmer, turn on my seat cooler, hey, call my husband," and it worked really, really well. And the design on the inside is particularly beautiful. It's just very Swedish in how well it's executed.
And you said it was affordable. What's the rate?
Well, I mean, it's affordable for the class. It starts at about $47,000, which I realize is a lot of money, but compared to other luxury cars of the same size, is actually pretty decent starting price. The other one was the Genesis G90. Now, Genesis is a spin-off luxury brand that's owned by Hyundai, and the G90 is their largest sedan. And it's a pretty nice, very large, comfortable car. It's one of those cars that you could start in Maine and just kind of point it down 95 and drive all the way to Florida without, becoming uncomfortable. So that'll be an interesting race to see which of those three wins Car of the Year. For the trucks, the finalist was the Ford Super Duty, the Honda Ridgeline, and the Nissan Titan. And of those, the Super Duty is a Super Duty. It's mainly a work truck if you've got a lot to tow. The Ridgeline, I think, is the most flexible of the three. I think, John, I think you've been in the Ridgeline, and it's one of those trucks where you get all the benefits of having a truck. You've got a bed. You get some towing ability. You get some decent hauling ability. But the Ridgeline drives very much like a conventional car, so there's not a lot of drawbacks to it. And the Titan is it's a new truck from Mazda, and it's again, very nice, lots of technology in there, good towing ability as well. And then the final category is one they added this year, which is the utility category. And in there, the finalists were the Chrysler Pacifica, the Honda CR-V, and the Mazda CX-9. And all three of those are great. But I have to say, I drove my kids to my mother's house from New Hampshire to D.C. in the Pacifica. And if there's another way to test a family hauler, or a better way, I haven't heard of it yet. But that Pacifica took everything that my 2 and 4 year old handed out, and then some. So it was really it's really a tough to beat if you're looking for a good minivan that's comfortable, that's stylish, that's reasonably fun to drive. For a minivan still, and has all of those features that really make life with little kids easier. The Pacifica is one to check out. CX-9 for Mazda is a great large SUV, pretty fun to drive. Again, even for a 3-row SUV. And then the Honda CR-V is, I think, something that a lot of people are familiar with. It's a compact it's a compact SUV, very practical, and really just checks all the boxes, affordable, reliable, and just really one of those good all-around cars. So any of those, any of those nine cars could win the awards in their category, and the winners will be announced at the Detroit Auto Show.
Excellent.
In January.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have a question for our experts, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
When Sharon was 5, there was a moment when everything changed.
I was outside playing on the street, blind man's bluff, and they took the blindfold off, and suddenly I didn't recognize anything. I was panicked. I didn't know where I was. From that moment on, it was my secret.
Stories of people getting lost and then being found, next time on Radiolab.
Join us tonight at 11 o'clock. There is an app for that, for listening to Maine Public Radio or Maine Public Classical anywhere you want. The Maine Public app is available for both Apple and Android smartphones, and it also gives you access to many of your favorite television programs from both Maine Public Television and PBS. And of course, it's easy to either listen or read Maine Public Radio news reports. You can easily find the Maine Public app in both the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store, and it's free.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, answers to your car questions. Our two favorite auto experts are on the line. Jamie Page Deaton is auto editor for U.S. News & World Report. John Paul is AAA's Northeast Car Doctor. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Let's go to the phones to Henry in Rockland. Hi, Henry. Welcome to the program.
My question is, I have a 2004 TDI Jetta wagon, which I love. I pull a small trailer with it, so I get 20 miles to a gallon when I'm pulling the trailer, and I get 40 miles to a gallon when I'm not. So I really like that aspect of it. What my question is what's Volkswagen going to do once they get the engine all straightened out? Are they going to drop them, or are we going to be able to buy? Am I going to be able to buy another one, or do you know where all of that's at?
Okay, Henrik, which of you is the Volkswagen person?
I think we both have some expertise in this. Volkswagen right now is looking at a lot of different issues they have. You know, the good thing is, Henry, that your car doesn't fall into any of the recall classifications. And even as Volkswagen is slowly going to come back into the market with diesels, they will probably have additives that will go in, like a lot of modern diesels do now, an exhaust additive that helps keep the nitrous oxide emissions down, so the NOx emissions down. So it'll be a combination of that. If you were going to replace your current Volkswagen with a gasoline car, the Golf Sport Wagon, which is very similar to your Jetta TDI wagon, with the gasoline engine, gets the last one I road tested out on the highway, it was getting 35 or 36 miles per gallon, and it would probably easily pull a small trailer.
Yeah. How has Volkswagen dealt with its issues? It seems to have a plan to keep its customers. Jamie, how would you rate how it's doing?
Well, I mean, I think given the giant mess they made for themselves, they're doing okay. They've had their plans approved by a judge to repair the engines and also provide some compensation to VW owners. But this has not come without cost. On Friday, I think, they sort of buried this story in with the LA Auto Show that was last week. They announced that they're laying off 30,000 people in part to pay for all of the settlements that they're going to have to do because of Dieselgate. They also announced that they're going to be investing a lot in the future on electric cars and other alternative fuels. So this is, I think, for a long time, VW is going to be feeling this. And, to John's point, yeah, VW owners, I mean, if I was Henry, I'd be hanging on to that 2004 TDI wagon because it's a great car. But in the future, they will have, I'm sure, some, diesel engines with the additives to clean up the emissions. But I think for a long time, this is really going to alter the face of VW. And it's going to be a long time before they're able to earn back consumer trust and really be able to position themselves as a leader when it comes to alternatives to gasoline.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Scott in Bangor. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I was listening to your earlier conversation regarding the electric cars and the Chevy Volt, and I have a 2017 Chevy Volt, and I've really just been extraordinarily pleased with the vehicle. We've taken several long trips to Boston in the car, and because of the on-reader, because any time we need to go first, go into a gas, fill up the gas tank, and the electric generator continues to power the electric motor. So it It is a car that, you know, it offers roughly 40 miles per charge, and we charge it overnight on the 120-volt portable charger that comes along with the vehicle. We had no need to install a 240-volt charger in the home, which that is a considerable extra expense. But you charge it overnight, you can get a full charge when you're using the 12-amp charging mode, and that gives us about 40 miles, which for the average day, that covers all of our driving. And then if you need to go further, that electric onboard generator really gives you all the power that you need to do whatever it is you're going to do. You can go, you know, going to Boston is no problem whatsoever.
Yeah. Scott, you're fading in and out. I'm sorry, your cell is a little dicey. But I did want to ask you, did you buy the Volt for, was this for philosophical reasons? Was it about, you know, using less energy or fewer emissions, or was it pure economics? What's your thinking?
It's a combination. It's certainly a philosophical commitment to lowering the carbon footprint, but I also believe strongly that we are going to have gas prices go back up. You know, we are currently in a really kind of a great time for low gas prices, but we are certainly going to see those gas prices rise again. And at that point in time, the Volt will be a really good economical choice. And with a starting price of around, I think it was $32,000 was the final agreed price, and then a $7,000 tax credit, it's not, so long as you have that kind of a tax liability, you can take the credit again. It makes a fair amount of financial sense. You get the latest technologies available, and the Chevy MyLink is a good, not great technology system. I have an Android phone, and the Android Auto syncs up with it very easily. So there's certainly a philosophical element to it. I want to get off of foreign sources of energy, such as oil, and I want to lower my carbon footprint. But it's also a good economic choice as well.
All right, Scott, thank you. Any comments, panel?
Yeah, just to clarify, Scott's talking about the Chevy Volt with a V, like Virginia. I was talking about the Chevy Bolt with a B, as in Boston. They're two different cars. Scott's car is what we call an extended range electric vehicle, or an extended range plug-in hybrid, where he has on board an electric motor that powers the car and he can charge the batteries up. But he also has on board a gasoline-powered generator. So when his car is out of electricity, that generator fires up and provides power for the car. On the Chevrolet Bolt, which hasn't been released yet, it's getting released at the end of the year, it is an all-electric car. So it has a longer electric range. Scott was talking about, you know, you get about 40 miles in the Volt. Right. In the Bolt, you get about a 250-mile all-electric range.
Yep.
And so the Bolt is a little bit, you know, it's two kind of different animals. With the Volt, you don't have the range anxiety because you've always got that gasoline engine that can kick in. And, you know, you honestly never have to plug it in if you don't want to. But the Bolt, you have to really worry about, you know, the electric car aspect of it. And I say worry, even though what I really mean is, you know, it's just something to consider. It's not necessarily a negative. But with the Bolt, you're not going to have any emissions at all at the tailpipe. With the Volt, if that gasoline engine fires up, you know, when you're on your way to Boston, yeah, you're going to have a little bit of a carbon footprint, but much, much less than a conventional car.
Has brand confusion been an issue here between the Volt and the Bolt? And might one consider maybe changing the name?
If, you know, if I was queen of GM, I certainly would have gone with two different names, because it's terrible because nobody ever knows what you're talking about. Especially, you know, if you talk to somebody about these cars and they've got a cold, good luck understanding what they're saying.
Right. Or they're 4 years old.
Let's
go to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I may lose signal soon. It's a matter of physics and chemistry. If you have an electric car in Maine, when it's 0 degrees, you're going to be using it for heat and for driving, and battery is less really powerful at 0 degrees, and so I'm not sure if electric cars really conducive to living in Maine.
Yeah, John Paul, can you?
Yeah, it actually is both cold and hot weather. We've done some extensive testing in a sealed chamber out in our AAA club out in California, where we've cooled the chamber down to, you know, sub-freezing temperatures and heated it up to, you know, what would be, you know, very hot temperatures. And we found that there was certainly some battery life changes in the Tesla, and I have a little bit more experience with that because I know someone who has one. And, you know, on a good day, they're getting 230, 200, and even 40 miles on a full charge. On a very cold day, a very cold New England day, it's still above 200 miles. So still not too bad. And the difference between the electric cars of today and the electric cars from maybe the 70s, I had a Renault LeCar that was converted by an electric car company in Acton, Massachusetts. It was terrible. It used 16 6-volt batteries, and it was slow as could be. And cars today are so much better. And whether it's something like the Bolt that's coming out, or the new, small, more affordable Tesla that's coming out, or even something, you know, that has a range of 100 miles or so with the Leaf or the Kia Soul has an electric car that also has a fast charging cycle. You know, for a lot of people, 100 miles can be just fine. And you look at even with the Volt with its 40 mile electric range, a lot of people only drive 10 or 12 miles each way back and forth to work, and they come in and they're done. They charge up. And I was talking to somebody the other day who kind of said, well, you know, an electric car, that means I have to plug it in every night. And I said, what do you do when you come home? And he said, well, I plug my phone in, I plug my laptop in. I said, it's just one more thing to plug in. It's just something else you get used to, and it becomes just a normal routine. You plug it in, and you spend your time plugging in and not going to the gas station, which is pretty good on some days.
1-800-399-3566. From Facebook, Maine Bob asks, looking forward to tips on using new-to-me traction control on my Subaru Forester. Previously, I've used ABS brakes and don't pump the brakes. What should I beware of to best drive a car with traction control?
Well, traction control keeps the drive wheels, the wheels that are typically going to slip. And in a Subaru, he's probably not even going to really use traction control very much because it's an all-wheel drive car. So you always have sort of one front wheel trying to move the car and one rear wheel trying to move the car. On a front-wheel drive car or rear-wheel drive car that has traction control, normally if you're on a slippery situation, you step on the accelerator, one wheel spins. Well, what happens is the system actually applies the brake on the wheel that's spinning, transfers the torque to the other side of the car, and then causes that wheel to start to turn. And if you're lucky, that wheel's in a place where you get a little bit more traction, and then it will go back and forth. On an all-wheel drive vehicle, it does the same thing, only it's just a little bit more complicated. So really nothing you have to worry about. Why they have a traction control defeat button where you can shut the traction control off, because there are some times where you actually want the wheels to spin. So you're stuck in some snow and you actually want to accelerate. You want to get the wheels to spin a little bit. That's when you want to shut it off. So traction control, fairly simple. It also includes most traction control systems in conjunction with ABS brakes also have stability control systems, which as you're taking a turn, the brake system may apply one brake or another to actually prevent you from getting into a skid. So a lot of benefits there. So you combine all this together, and even a novice winter driver becomes a pretty good winter driver.
All right, let's go to Margaret in Orland. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. I have a Nissan Leaf 2015 model, but I bought it in the fall of 2014. So I've had it through two winters, and even that big, heavy snow winter, and it's performed wonderfully. I kept my old Honda Civic 96, which still works like a charm, as a backup because, you know, obviously an all-electric car would have some limitations, and its limitations are, I would say, 95 miles range in the winter and 105 to 110 in the summer. So far, you know, it's worked almost perfectly for me in terms of all my needs. I've had to use the Honda Civic a few times to go beyond that range, and that's good to have it. But anyway, I am glad that the discussion of electric cars now in your program, because of callers, is being opened up beyond just saving money from gas. Let's remember, everybody, that it's our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren ahead of us who need a better environment, or maybe even a world that works at all. And we have to do our part to do whatever we can to reduce our carbon footprint, and that has great value, not just how much money you spend in the short term at the gas pump. Thank you.
All right, Margaret, thank you very much. With that, we'll take a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Casella, converting landfill gas to electricity. Committed to providing clean, renewable energy for Mainers. Casella, giving resources new life. And Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco.
This is The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
On the next Fresh Air, Trevor Noah, the host of The Daily Show, talks about satirizing the news in the Donald Trump era and growing up biracial in South Africa, where when he was born, it was illegal for his black mother and white father to have had intimate relations. That's why Noah's new memoir is called Born a Crime. Join us.
Tune in to Fresh Air coming up tonight at 7 o'clock. And in 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock public affairs hour, the Commonwealth Club of California welcomes the founder of Patagonia, Inc., as he recounts his early days of selling climbing equipment out of his car and explains how that led to accidentally creating a multi-million dollar sporting goods company committed to environmentally responsible design and production. Again, that's coming up in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all things automotive. Jamie and John are on the line. Jamie Page Deaton with U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul with AAA Northeast, and a master mechanic. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Alan in Waterford. Hi, Alan. Hi, Alan. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, hi. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I'm in the market for a new car, but it seems like most cars today are configured for five people. And I'm interested in a car that will take six adults and, you know, senior citizen type folks who need access to that third row of seats really easily. Can you make a recommendation?
Jamie?
Alan, you want a minivan. I know that they're not the coolest cars out there, but in terms of ease of access, particularly with people who might have limited mobility, and you want to have, you know, six adults sitting comfortably, you want to look at a minivan. I think some of the top choices are, you know, the Chrysler Pacifica that I mentioned earlier. Also, the Honda Odyssey and Toyota Sienna are both very nice vans. The Sienna is one that you can get with all-wheel drive, though I think, honestly, if you just get a front-wheel drive van and you put snow tires on it, you'll be fine for most situations. But it's really, people, you know, kind of scoff at minivans because they're not particularly cool. But when you're talking about those sliding rear doors that open so widely, and then the ease of being able to just basically walk into the third row as opposed to having to climb up and over seats like you would in an SUV, really a minivan is the way to go. Because beyond that, you're looking at a three-row SUV. And while there are a couple of options that can handle adults comfortably in the seats, like what's coming to mind, the Buick Enclave has a great third-row seat. Getting to that third row can be difficult, particularly, again, you know, if you're a little bit older and, you know, maybe not as spry as you used to be. So really, Alan, I would, if I was you, go take a look at a minivan. All of them on the market today are very good, but really the best ones are the Chrysler Pacifica, Honda Odyssey, and Toyota Sienna.
Are there big price differences between those three?
No, I mean, if those are priced about the same, and they go from, you know, very basic kind of on the inside to, you know, if you go to the upper end of the Sienna, I mean, it comes close to $50,000 and the inside is like a Lexus. If you want to save a little bit of money, the Kia Sedona is another great van that starts at a little bit less money than the other ones. But again, it still follows that basic minivan framework where you have a comfortable box in which you can handle, you know, up to seven adults comfortably.
Okay, Alan, best of luck in your search. Let's go to Dave in North Yarmouth. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the electric cars. I'm very curious. I've wanted to get an electric car for a while. However, I'm very concerned about what happens to your electric car when it breaks. Where do you take it? How much does it cost? And how does that compare to fixing a regular car?
John Paul?
Well, they don't break as often, which is one thing, because they're in some ways they're a lot simpler. Sure, there's a lot more computerized parts in it. So in the short term, at least, the dealership is where you're going to end up. Although there are aftermarket specialists now that work on electric cars. In fact, in Massachusetts, there's a guy who's been around for years who is sort of a hybrid electric car trainer, and he goes out on the road and trains independent mechanics all over the country, and in fact, in some cases around the world, how to fix and maintain electric vehicles. But for the most part, an electric vehicle, the brakes barely wear at all. Because you're taking your foot off the accelerator and the electric motor is trying to recharge the battery a little bit. Same thing with a hybrid. If you're looking at a hybrid as opposed to an electric car, same thing. There's a little bit of regular maintenance that any garage can do, oil changes and things like that. But a pure electric car, even when it comes down to replacing the battery in the car, there's some very set procedures, and you just follow the procedures and replace the battery as a complete unit, and it makes it relatively easy. You're still going to run into problems with things like, you know, if the air conditioner doesn't work and the heater doesn't work and, you know, the stereo system isn't working properly. Those are, although their systems are different, they're still the same as what we've been fixing, with maybe a different, the air conditioner and compressor may use an electric motor rather than be belt driven by a gasoline engine. So there's going to be some differences, but again, the basics are the same. So a good repair technician that can fix a gasoline car, I would say within a couple of years, as they get more familiar with electric cars, they're going to be able to. They do have to make an investment in some special tools, special insulated hand tools, as well as rubber gloves, very similar to the ones you see that electrical workers that are working on high tension lines use, and they have to get tested every 6 months to make sure there's no cracks or wear in them, so there's no chances of getting hurt by the electric battery system. But, you know, going back to the dealer is part of it. And what's interesting about the Tesla is and we're starting to see this in some other cars, when it comes down to fixes, it used to be we fixed cars with mechanical parts. Now what we're doing is we're fixing cars with software updates in some cases. So sure, if the door doesn't work, you have to fix something mechanical. But sometimes if the car isn't running properly, it's a software update. And Tesla does a lot of these software updates while you're sleeping. You wake up in the morning and your car is a little bit different car because it downloaded a new software program while you were sleeping.
That's right. Well, I witnessed that this morning before the show in my Tesla ride. Very interesting. Connected directly to Tesla, not through a dealership. They're talking directly to the engineers, and they can make upgrades to the car as well, simply by indicating they want to do that. Let's go to Lion in Fort Fairfield. Hi, Lion.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I heard that you guys were talking about electric cars, and I've always been interested in them. However, they haven't really been at a good price point for my income. Do you ever see an electric car price point coming down, maybe even to the low 20s? I know the Chevy Volt is somewhere in the 30s. Do you ever see that price coming down?
Jamie?
Yeah, I think it's going to take a while. You know, while the technology becomes more mainstream, and again, you know, as there's more investment in it and electric cars take off and car companies start to recoup some of their initial investment in the development of this technology, you'll see the price come down. And the question of whether or not, you know, a brand new electric car will ever be around $20,000, I think is a pretty interesting one. Because if you just look at overall, the average price of a new car right now is above $32,000. And that's all cars, gasoline, electric, hybrid, diesel, you name it. And so the price of cars is only going up. In fact, if you go and you look at kind of the affordable small car class, you know, the Mitsubishi Mirage that John was talking about earlier is one of the more affordable cars and one of the more affordable new cars you can buy. And it's $17,000. So for, you know, something that has kind of this newer technology coming in at about $20,000, that I think is going to be a little bit of a long shot within the next couple of years, just because overall the price of cars is increasing. And that's due, you know, to a couple of different reasons. One is all the new technology in cars. Two, and you, and when I say the new technology, I'm not just talking about new propulsion systems, like electric drivetrains. I'm also talking about safety systems like traction control, advanced driver assistance features, and other safety, advancements there. But also consumers are demanding a lot more content. So the reason that Mitsubishi Mirage is starting at, $17,000 as opposed to $12,000 is, as John said, because it's got Apple CarPlay, because it's got Android Auto, because it's got push-button start, and it has those things because that's what consumers, even in the most affordable classes, are looking for. So I think, if you're looking for an affordable electric car, wait a couple of years and prices will drop. Or look for one that's coming off of a lease, because what a lot of people are doing with these electric cars are they're leasing them for a couple of years. And then they're, moving on to the next thing so they can keep taking advantage of the latest technology. And when you look at these cars coming off of a lease, Margaret was talking about her Chevrolet Leaf, or I'm sorry, her Nissan Leaf. But you can one of those now for about $8,000, and it's an all-electric car. It's not the latest and greatest technology, but it is an electric drivetrain, and it's one that you can get now that's fairly affordable. You can also get a Chevrolet Volt, the one that starts with a V like Virginia, which is, a gas-electric, extended-range electric. Those are coming off leases now, some of the first generation, and those prices are, right around, and in some cases, below $20,000. So really, if you start doing your homework and you're willing to take on a used model, you can do pretty well. But if you're looking for a new one, prices might get into the 20s, but ever hitting kind of the low 20s or around that exact $20,000 mark, I think is probably unlikely.
All right. We've got about 1 minute left. We'll go to Bill in Limerick. Hi, Bill. Real quickly, if you don't mind, please. Thanks.
Yep, real quick. I own two TDI wagons and was wondering if Volkswagen had yet posted the new mileage rating and the new horsepower and torque ratings. Thank you.
Which,
John? It's my understanding that you're going to actually get what the EPA sticker actually said on the side of the car. Because what happened, the fix that I saw, and this fix was about 6 or 8 months old, the fuel economy actually was about what you said you were going to get, and maybe 0 to 60 in about 1 second slower than you're getting now. So for most people, you're not really going to notice any difference. The thing of it was the window sticker told you you're going to get 43 miles per gallon, and most people got 50, and that was because of the manipulation of the system. So I think you're going to see closer to what you were promised from the beginning, and I don't think you're going to get any less than that.
All right, Tom, best of luck. We'll fit one more in. Andy in Freeport, about 30 seconds.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a 2001 Toyota Camry with over 300,000 miles on it, so I'm obviously going to be in the market for a new vehicle. I'd like something with probably four-wheel drive, better in ice and snow, and something that's it's going to be reliable, like the Camry, and affordable, because I commute about 70 miles round trip.
Jamie, in 30 seconds or less.
Subaru Legacy.
And you're so predictable.
I know. It's Maine. You got to recommend a Subaru at least once a show.
All right. Andy in Freeport, best of luck. And Jamie and John, thank you both for joining us again today.
Take care
and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Jamie Page Deaton, auto editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul, master mechanic and senior manager of public affairs for AAA Northeast. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about optimism and the role it can play in our health, well-being, and even in how society functions. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.